Right now, there have been changes at the site of a super volcano that overlooks the Italian city of Naples, and scientists can't agree if the signs point toward a catastrophic eruption or not.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she's with us once a month to talk about the latest cool science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, friends, on this gorgeous autumn day.
Yes, and not so gorgeous. This super volcano, from, I guess, an awesome perspective, it is that. But Gemma, tell us about what we know about this super volcano in Italy.
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing is when you talk about Naples, one of Italy's largest cities, and then you talk about kind of a volcanic threat there, I think almost all of us would think immediately of Mount Vesuvius, which is kind of on the city's edge. But it turns out Mount Vesuvius is second banana to an even bigger threat that a lot of people don't know about. It's called Campi Flegrei, and apologies to any native Italian speakers for mangling that pronunciation. Probably got it wrong. But this is basically a caldera or a super volcano that sits right underneath some of Naples' most densely populated suburbs.
And the landscape of this area, it sounds like in large part, was built when this caldera, this super volcano, blew up, hundreds of thousands of years ago?
Well, it's blown up a couple times. It's erupted a few times that we know of. The biggest eruption from it, the most powerful one, was about 40,000 years ago, and it sent 300 cubic kilometers of ash and rock skyward. It impacted global climate. There's some research out that thinks that the way it changed climate may have spelled kind of the death knell for Neanderthals, which went extinct right around that time. So there are all these the terrible things associated with the last enormous eruption, the most powerful one. But it has kind of blown its top a few times since then, not on such a great scale, though.
And Gemma, what makes a supervolcano a supervolcano?
That's a good question, and that's why I'm kind of shying away from using the term supervolcano. The scientists we talked to for this story much prefer the term caldera, and that is because of the kind of volcano it is, but also because there is, believe it or not, there is no scientifically agreed and evidence-backed definition of supervolcano. So the researchers really prefer to call it a caldera. It is one big volcano, okay? However you want to call it, it's a big one.
Now, scientists and people there, and I guess people around the world, should be wondering, well, how do we know if this thing's going to blow up again? What are scientists on site monitoring as they watch this?
Well, they're monitoring so many different things. And you know, that's kind of one of the interesting things about the most recent research, because there were two papers out in the last year, and the scientists who authored the papers used the same data, and they reached different conclusions. And that's because we really, in 2017, we still don't really understand how volcanoes in general, and in particular, the large ones, the calderas, we really don't understand exactly how they work. But they agree on one thing. It's doing something. The volcano is doing something anomalous. And when they're monitoring, they're looking at what kind of gases it's emitting. They're looking at how hot the rock is and how much heat is being transferred from the magma chamber that is underneath the volcano and into the rock. And they're looking for signs. Is the rock weakening? Is it bending? Is it reaching the point where it might not be able to bend anymore as the pressure grows? And they even look at the composition of the gases being emitted, because that can be a clue that the volcano is getting to do something.
What do we know about what could happen if the caldera were to erupt?
It would not be good. I mean, that's kind of the short way to put it. But, you know, a lot of scientists, obviously, because this could affect millions of people, it could affect millions of Neapolitans very immediately and very directly and very catastrophically. And in addition to that, it could also affect things like agriculture, air travel. The entire economy of Europe might be affected. So what they do is they draw up these maps based on previous eruptions and the signs that they left us in terms of damage, as well as things like wind patterns. So the people in Naples would be very much affected by pyroclastic flow, for example, and that is a really horrific kind of a super hot rock avalanche. But they would also be affected by ash, and they think that there might be enough ash shot upward in the sky that as it fell, it could pretty much flatten the city, which would, of course, be horrible. And there's so many different ways of looking at this, but let's just say if it does erupt, it would be catastrophic.
Now, this is something, a volcano that's moving in many ways on geologic timescales, and we're, of course, living in human timescales. How accurate can we be of saying if this is going to, is this something that could happen in the next 10 years or the next 1,000 years?
Well, you know, the thing with this particular caldera, and it's true of actually many calderas around the world, it does not have a set eruption pattern. You know, some volcanoes do. You could say, oh, it erupts every 1,000 years or every 100,000 years. But this one, there's no rhyme or reason to its eruption schedule. So because of that, and because the researchers are not exactly sure what the things it's doing right now actually mean, they're not willing to put any kind of guesstimate on when it might erupt, or even if it might erupt. There's actually a school of thought about this volcano that the signs that we're seeing, the changes in the elasticity of rock and the changes in the gas composition, this might actually be a sign that it's going dormant, that it's shutting down. So unfortunately, they're a huge mystery, and we really don't know that much about calderas, but everyone agrees that this particular one is doing something.
Gemma Tarlak is with us right now. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, looking at some cool science news right now. And Gemma, there is an archaeological site off the shore of a lake in an Istanbul suburb that is yielding some fascinating findings. What's the story there?
Yeah, this is neat. And I have to say, this is our inaugural on-site mini column. And we really want to take readers to some of these fascinating archaeological sites where there's work underway, there are really interesting finds, but they might not make the biggest headlines. And this particular site, it's called Bathnaya, and it is indeed on the outskirts of a lake in Istanbul. And, you know, this researcher 10 years ago said, I think there's got to be something there. And all her colleagues kind of laughed her off, like, no, there's nothing there. Why would there be something there? She started digging, her team started digging, and they have found incredible artifacts. Some of them are almost a million years old, but as they're digging through the layers, they found these prehistoric artifacts, as well as, you know, from the ancient Greek era, from the Byzantine Empire. It's a treasure trove, really. And personally, I think the most interesting find is it's an ancient drugstore. They have found hundreds of these small ceramic and glass bottles all in this one little area, and they analyzed the chemical residue left inside the bottles, and it bears remarkably similar chemical footprints to some of the drugs we use today to treat depression and heart disease.
And when do we date that to?
That is, I believe, from about 2 millennia ago.
And so what's next for this site, Gemma?
They're still digging.
We don't know everything.
Yeah, as long as they find stuff, they're just going to keep digging. And, you know, it's one of those wonderful sites where layer upon layer upon layer of different people, different cultures, different civilizations have been preserved. So they're just going to, you know, keep at it until they can't find anything else.
And then finally, there was a piece on color in this month's edition and things we didn't know about color and some scary stuff about how people historically colored their food and milk. Some yucky stuff got put in there to make it look better.
Yeah, I found this fascinating that back in the day, to hide the fact that they had watered down their dairy so, you know, they can make more money off of it, producers used to tint the milk yellow with lead chromate. Don't do this at home, folks, okay? Just don't do that. So anyway, so they would tint the milk, and it would be yellow to hide the fact that it was watered down. And then when they started actually selling white milk, kind of, you know, pure white goodness, white milk, people refused to buy it because it wasn't yellow, so they assumed it had been colored white and that there was something wrong with the milk.
Wow. Well, there's also some stuff that I have seen in my own marriage, men and women reacting differently to color, seeing color differently.
Yeah, you know, and in particular, the gene mutation that makes people with XY chromosomes red-green colorblind, so they have a lot of difficulty seeing colors as most of the population sees them. That same genetic mutation in people with double X chromosomes, they think it might be enhanced color vision. It might be something called tetrachromacy, which means instead of, like most humans, you see red, green, and blue, you actually see a fourth color. Now, don't ask me what that color is, because there are so few people with documented tetrachromacy that researchers aren't really sure. But this is an area of color research that's really picking up. And it was actually just in 2010 that they think they identified the first person with tetrachromacy or four-color vision.
So it's kind of like a superpower in a way. Theoretically, it sounds like there's argument about this, but they might actually distinguish more gradations of color.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you looked at, say, a brick in a wall, and it looked like a flat gray brick to you, a person with tetrachromacy might see other shades of color in it, not just, you know, a flat gray, but they might see other shades of colors you can't see, and even maybe colors you can see but don't particularly see in that brick. So they're still figuring out, and there's still a lot of debate in research circles, like exactly what does it mean, exactly what are they seeing? Because, you know, if you can't see it, how do you know that the person's really seeing it, right? They're trying to figure out ways to measure it and really quantify it to be able to study it in, you know, a really scientific manner.
Gemma, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us about once a month to share interesting science news. You know, I don't think I have any kind of color blindness, but I definitely have a more limited range of color detection ability than many people around me.
I would say
life.
That's true. Like, fact check. Yes. That's
true. Is light blue? Are we in agreement on this?
That's light blue.
We argue at home about the colors of things.
I do with my husband more than you one might
think. I suspect that I'm wrong,
actually.
Usually.
But I mean, I guess it just, you're both right, because it sounds like we're both seeing different versions of the same color.
What a lovely way to look at it.
Thank you.